Today, it's a clown show. Economic update for February 2026. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Well, I caught up with Alex again and we made our monthly economic update show. And frankly, it's clear that the clowns are in town. We went through quite a lot of detailed information and I hope you enjoy this. It's my version of the show recorded with him on his channel.
Hi guys, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Nuggets News. We're back with our monthly housing and economy update with our friend Martin North from across the pond, other side of the world. How are you, Martin?
Yes, I'm very good, although the world continues to confuse in my view. Wherever you look, there's chaos and confusion. So we're going to try and cast a little light on what's going on and ask a few rather important questions.
Chaos, confusion, and distractions everywhere as well, right? Yeah, so let's get into these slides, and there's a few things to have some rants about tonight, indeed.
So the first is obviously we have the State of the Union, very long speech from Trump, ranting and raving, frankly, about the court's decision on trade, which we'll come on to, but avoiding assiduously Epstein and a few other things too. More heat than light in my view, but it is just worth acknowledging that, things are not going that well. If you look at his approval rating, it's way down. And if you think of what's happened to markets around the world since his return, the US is ranked 21st out of 23 developed markets. So Austria, Spain, way at the top, New Zealand below the US, but Australia above the US in terms of performance. So I think that's a little observation that's quite interesting.
Yeah, and you've got the AI we want to get into.
Yeah, well, let's talk about AI because, there's a lot of rubbish, again, being spoken about AI. There's a school of thought that says, look, AI is nothing more than just ultra-fast querying and search, but no intelligence at all. That's all it is. It's just fast, right? And the truth is, of course, that whether you believe that or not, what's happened now with particularly Anthropic recently is they're starting to impact other stocks through their Claude app. And now we've seen it sort of IBM got hit because of the COBOL streamline coding that it's got. Adobe fell. Cybersecurity and things like, CrowdStrike also hit. So software stocks are now being impacted again, as others were, wealth management. And pretty much everywhere you look, there are huge disruptions to markets. And on the next slide, just to show you that this is actually just four different examples, IBM way down, CrowdStrike way down, SAP, the big behemoth in Europe in terms of software, and even Australia Technology One way down. So there's some really big shifts here in terms of what's going on. And the question is, well, what is AI about? Is it really about just, more powerful search? Or is it more? And the next slide is just showing you, people are talking about, there's a loop that says you're going to see hedge count being cut, wages go down, consumption goes down, but more investment in AI, and that's going to be a doom loop path to the future. Or is it going to create what's called an abundance gap, where with AI capability rising, service costs go down, the real purchasing power of people go up, demand expands. Is it going to create effectively an invisible tax cut? Nobody knows. And there's a lot of speculation out there, a lot of rubbish being taught. I would say that it's probably too soon to say precisely what it is. But just on the next slide, it is worth noting that this article from Stanford and Harvard just came out calling it the Agents of Chaos. And I think this is quite important because they're talking here about when you start getting AIs talking to AIs, when you actually create connections between these various entities, maybe what you're creating is a system of chaos driven by a level of incentives that actually mirrors the real world, and the real world ain't nice. So, where is the future going? We don't know, but this is one to watch.
Yeah, I think the important thing to take away here is what you saw with like those malt bots and making their own version of Reddit, and they're all chatting to each other. They very quickly start figuring out how to do anti-human things because they're not human. They don't have those human emotions and that. And I think that's a really important aspect. And like we've seen with Commonwealth, the other aspect is that they're happy to cut jobs or outsource jobs, even though they're making those record profits, So again, it's almost like the corporations of the modern world don't have that human element of compassion. They don't really care about their employees. And this all comes back to that model of centralizing power, right? If every little town had their own bank and all the employees know each other and know other people in the town, it's a lot harder to cut jobs. When it's just a faceless person at the top of a company, and I think this is all the stuff that the pendulum's going to swing back on, and people are going to ask, well, what's the point of AI if it's just getting rid of all human jobs? And then what do we do with all humans? And if AI are in charge of everything at that point, what are they going to want to do with all humans? So it's pretty crazy stuff to think about, right?
Well, it is. And, you know, nobody knows where this is going to run. But there are a few entities making massive amounts, creating significant disruption in markets, in people's lives. And I don't know whether you've ever tried to speak to your bank recently, but it's almost impossible now. So we've lost something really important here, that physical interaction, that face-to-face, that immediacy. And you know, this is the early days of the evolution of AI. But just remember, there's a huge amount of capital being invested. The returns probably aren't there for many people, though it's worth noting NVIDIA, of course, is reporting tomorrow. And the NVIDIA story is now their share price is up a little bit from where it was. It dipped quite a long way back. Dan Ives, who's a stalwart in terms of the future of AI and everything else, is saying this result from NVIDIA will be an important test because they've got to start showing returns on their investments. At the moment, there's a lot of swinging capital around in the system, people borrowing from other parts of the system, but not necessarily creating real value. So there's a real value question. But that strategic question that we've touched on is probably the more important one. Where is it leading us?
The other thing you touched on there, Martin, was when you can't get someone on the phone at the bank, or, you know, social media is another big one. If your Facebook gets hacked or something, they don't have a contact number or email. Mm. And as everything goes digital, particularly if they get this digital ID that they want, you're not going to have anyone to call other than AI chatbot for all your services, particularly if you opt out and you don't want that digital ID and stuff. So it's almost like they're just making it impossible to be able to do anything unless you fully comply and you're up to date with how they want things. It's another thing that's pretty scary.
And look, if the computer says no, and you can't actually get anyone to talk to, and the branch is closed, you know, because they don't have branches anymore, you are basically under the thumb of that technology.
Yes. Okay.
Well, let's just talk briefly about the markets now, because of course we had the tariff shifts. With the decision last week, very interesting ruling, 6-3. The post I made was about markets, and originally says, well, nothing to see much here, you know, and they sort of just pretty much ignored it. It's worth saying, if you go to the next slide, of course, that there was a bit of confusion. Tariffs 15%, tariffs 10%, nobody quite knows. Trump came out and said, well, I'm going to use Section 122 to actually impose it for 150 days, and he said then a bit later, 15%. So it is unclear. It is unclear about where this tariff, don't expect tariffs to go away. But of course, people are looking to reclaim some of the higher tariffs that were taken. Some of the level playing field discussions now are back in play because Australia, which of course had a bit of an advantage, now perhaps has less an advantage. So these are big deals. But just the other way to look at it on the next slide, if you look at it in terms of the trade deficit, remember that tariff was about bringing stuff back home to the US. Guess what? The trade deficit is one of the largest since 1960. And as Peter Schiff tweeted out, there's no evidence that Trump's tariffs are achieving their desired goals. It's about, what is it? It's about positioning, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe some people are wanting to accept the lies, but maybe voters won't. And of course, we've got midterms coming up. So it's a big deal.
Yeah, and people talking about Australia surpassing that $1 trillion debt. But as you see there, US $1 trillion a year deficit. And no other country gets away with it unless you've got that reserve currency and that kind of sentiment towards the US and politics and Israel is all changing. So I think their economy, as in the everyday person and jobs, is in for a rough time. But I don't think that necessarily affects like the tech sector and the, you know, it's just a different realm almost.
It's an us and them situation, as we've said previously, and it's getting worse. Bearing in mind the midterms are coming up, of course, Trump did sort of half talk about, affordability in his speech. But really, you know, the truth is many people in the US, as in Australia, are under the gun. And by the way, the latest data for the US showed that the inflation data was up. The PCE was actually a little higher. The Fed, of course, is now worrying maybe about having to lift rates. And there's a couple of recent Fed speak examples where people were talking about, well, maybe we actually can't cut rates anymore. You know, the markets are wobbly, maybe. But if you look at it more broadly and you look at the S&P 500, well, you know, we are close to all-time highs on the S&P 500, despite all of this rotation, despite all the fears. Goldman Sachs says the US stock market pullback poses the top near-term economic risk. So the question is, you know, what is the impact of that? What's the wealth effect going to be? What's it mean in terms of the midterms if it does pull back? And so there's a lot of uncertainty. And this is a bubbly high, although it's actually slightly broader than just posted now through AI. But it really is on quite uncomfortable ground. Another way of looking at it, if you look at the bond yields in the US, they're down a little, but the markets now are speculating about the next rate cut or rate rise. No, nobody's quite sure. That's one of the reasons why on the next slide, gold, of course, is still very much in vogue with more than 5,200 US now, the sort of price. More people are drifting towards gold because of the uncertainty of everything else, which is, I think, important to understand. People are seeking some sort of safe haven in an unsafe world.
Yeah, I think the other thing with gold, silver, and America wanting to open, you know, commodities and mining and bring a lot of that home, if they, you know, people argue the price of silver has been suppressed in gold for years. If they really pump up those prices in America and are now capitalizing on all that mining, that's going to be another sort of broad index of all those stocks and everything that kind of benefit and maybe some jobs. So that's just another mental note, I think, to make. Yeah.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, it is fascinating to see how people are trying to explain the story about gold. And none of the stories actually, I think, are telling the full story. I think you could say that the same of Bitcoin. If you look at the next slide there, Bitcoin, of course, is down around 65,000 at the moment. People were saying, oh, if it gets towards 60, it'll drop a lot further. A lot of other people are saying, well, it's being manipulated with some of the big players, you know, buying and selling at set times across the day, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know quite what is the story, other than just to remind everybody that Bitcoin has been volatile right from inception. And, you know, people are sometimes saying, well, maybe this is different. Or maybe it's not.
Yeah, I see you've got the slide here about Michael Saylor being underwater. And I guess that strategy of like borrowing debt on a really risky asset and trying to, this is kind of something we touched on like ages ago, that when all these companies are starting to talk about treasuries, you kind of get this feeling that we're getting late to the party now, right? And you shouldn't be borrowing money to buy anything that's got a parabolic chart. Okay,
so no, I think that's good advice. Yeah, and you know, Saylor is now in what, $7 billion down in terms of his Bitcoin bet, but still buying Bitcoin, so still averaging and averaging down. But no, I mean, people are holding out. This is an example of watch what happens here, because as you say, it's late cycle. But you know, as to whether the Bitcoin story is completely over or whether this is just the latest in a series of ups and downs, I can't tell. I don't think you can tell. So I guess it's back to your religious view of where you think Bitcoin's going to go.
I just think it's in a battle now. It's being captured by a lot of the centralized banks and Powell's and BlackRock, and there's still good developers out there that want decentralization and privacy and all that. So it's kind of got a, it's just a bit of uncertainty there at the moment. But I think I can't see it like going to zero or anything like that. I think it is still the best asset to keep outside the banks that's digital. Like, you can still store it yourself and they can't freeze your account. And that's still important in the global environment we're in. So it's still one of the best hopes that we've got. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of thinking about it. Best hope, maybe, but very, very unclear. And another unclear, just before we go on, Blue Owl, which is a private equity credit group, right, announced that they were going to restrict investors from pulling out from their funds. And the question, of course, is that just idiosyncratic, or is that also another sector where the rules of the road, old world versus new world, are being contested again? And I actually think private credit, to my mind, has a lot of parallels to the Bitcoin story, and a lot of questions need to be asked.
Yeah, it's similar to what we've touched on with those real estate trusts where they trade liquid in ETFs and that, but the reality is the assets that back them aren't always liquid and you can't always sell if you want. And that again gets into self-custody of wealth. So yeah.
Absolutely right. Let's talk about Australia because of course the ASX 200 hit a new all-time high again. Why, you might ask? Well, that's a good question, but it is fascinating, as I said earlier on, that the Australian market has outperformed the US under Trump. So, you know, whether that's something to do with it. It's also worth highlighting, I think, that the two-year yield in Australia is, again, quite high, 4.233. So that's a forward view of where rates are going to go, and that's important, as we'll see in a second. Oh, and the exchange rate, because of that expectation of perhaps more rate rises, the exchange rate against the US is a lot stronger now at 0.711. And you can see there that there's a really big swing around in terms of the Aussie dollar, which may have some good points in terms of the impact in terms of imports versus exports and inflation. But we have to look at what's happening in Australia. I made a show the other day about jobs means more rate hikes incoming. And that's because the latest jobs numbers were actually quite positive in terms of the unemployment rate was quite low. It's below what the RBA thought it was going to be. There you can see on the next slide. So there's a big question. What is the state of the economy? Well, from a jobs perspective, yeah, jobs are there, although remember they're defining unemployment in a very particular way. But with regard to income, that's a more interesting story because I made a show the other day highlighting 15 years of no real income growth. And I don't know whether you saw the Senate estimates with Matt Canavan, but he was talking with the RBA about them gaslighting this number because they've started to use not the wage price index, but they've started to use a different measure now of income growth, including superannuation and people shifting from job A to job B and overtime. Now, think about it, that superannuation to 12% is not something you can access immediately. None of this includes taxation, which is up, as we'll see in a second. So the real story of income growth is probably more represented in this chart. And basically, they're forecasting it's going to actually continue to grind lower, which absolutely then poses the question, so who on earth is gaslighting who?
Yeah, that is pretty crazy, isn't it? The other thing with this, I just think about with that productivity now and, you know, what we spoke about with outsourced to foreign workers and AI and stuff. I was speaking to someone the other day, and again, they have a small issue with their whatever it was, home internet service, and they end up doing this runaround between the company and then Telstra and then the bank and then Centrelink. And, you know, think about all these staff that are involved in this red tape thing and yeah, this 8 hours for like this. It's just not this productivity. We're not creating new jobs and new businesses or anything. It's just wild watch how like nothing gets done without like four people having to sign off on something these days, no matter what industry you're in. And it's just crazy. It's stifling that productivity like we always talk about.
Well, we talk about a lot of the market sector jobs versus non-market sector jobs, and the growth has been in market sector. 83% of jobs growth has been in the non-market sector. In other words, directly or indirectly funded by government. And as you say, there are a lot of hangers-on, a lot of supporting people, not actually adding to the productivity. Productivity is a real key. And of course, if you go to the next slide, Bullock has been talking about the issues with regard to productivity. Chalmers is now under huge pressure because, of course, he created some of this inflationary pressures. We'll see in a second. Electricity subsidies, for example, now unwinding. But Bullock basically saying, well, we're going to have to lift rates higher because the economy is absolutely going flat out. You know, there is no capacity to cut rates anytime soon. Though, interestingly, I think Christopher Joy commented, the RBA has no idea in what it's doing right now. It's caught in the middle of a tug of war between the preferences of its political masters and the policy constraints imposed by the hard data. The casualty is its credibility. Well, I'd say partly, but the other thing is that the casualty is ordinary Australians who are actually now expected to pay higher rates on their mortgages. People are now thinking the next rate could be as March. And in fact, the CPI data that came out today showed that the headline CPI was 3.8. The trimmed mean was 3.36, around 3.4. And you can see the trends there. Adam Crichton said inflation will remain above the midpoint of the RBA's target band for 27 quarters, only 7 years, if the RBA's forecasts hold. What a demonstrably stupid system. And Warren Hogan said March hike looking like a cheap option. We are looking at higher rates. This is disaster.
Do you remember over the years, Mark, when we share those long-term charts of interest rates trending towards zero and negative, and then you think about the debt, and it's just mathematically impossible to keep these rates high with this debt. Like, something has to give, and that is what we are in the midst of now. It's just
correct.
The financial system and economics, traditionally as it's taught, doesn't have an answer for this. It's just, you know, oh, the debt doesn't really matter, or, you know, it'll come down, or productivity. But it's mathematically impossible. And this is why these old systems, I think, are collapsing. And the question is, well, how does it all reset? Is it commodity backed and gold has to reprice? You know, all these questions. But the financial system's never been more unstable in these very traditionally safe economies and financial institutions, right?
And of course, it's falling back onto ordinary people. So the mortgage stress numbers are very high. The rental stress numbers are even higher. And just remember, the next slide shows you that the tax take is expected to continue to rise. This is from the PBO forecast, right? So we are actually being taxed ever more heavily to subsidize an ever greater public sector that is actually incurring extra interest rate costs that have to be covered. What is that money being spent on? It's not necessarily being spent on the things that actually will benefit Australia or Australians, in my view. The AUKUS thing just continues to rot away in the background, right? And I could talk about a lot of other rather silly policies as well, including a lot of the housing ones. But the bottom line is, in Australia, all we have is the quantitative easing game of importing more people, right? This is the only lever that the Australian government has employed. Is effectively high migration. I made a show with people sitting on the wings of an aircraft coming into Australia. I thought that was quite appropriate. And I'm finding it really fascinating here that Anthony Albanese reportedly said he's dismissed the idea of immigration cuts or tighter border checks, even as electoral polls show a surge in support for the country's hard right One Nation Party. We'll come back to those polls in a second. And it's interesting that Costello's come out and said, we've wasted 20 years' time to rebuild a great nation. Actually, the seeds of destruction were sown in the Costello and Howard years. This is not new. This is just the continued amping up of some of those old strategies. And a good example of that, if you want to take it a bit further, is the capital gains. Here's a chart that showed what happened when the capital gains discount began and what happened to dwelling prices versus disposable income per capita. It was part of the problem. Not the only one. Deregulation, easier lending, a bunch of things there too, but they're part of the problem. So, you know, Costello coming around and saying, oh, you've blown it. Well, yeah, you created the problem too, Costello.
Well, it's death by a thousand cuts, isn't it, with all these agendas they push? And you can argue it goes back even further when they started to gut manufacturing and we become more and more of a consumer economy and just pumping up house prices. And again, it all leads into not actually doing anything really productive. And man, aren't we starting to see cracks with social cohesion and division as a result of this immigration? And absolutely, the media ramps that up and plays on people's fears and makes it worse. But yeah, we're just slowly losing that kind of culture and identity and all this stuff because they're flooding us with people. And it's certainly not for the best jobs. And a lot of these people end up on welfare and all that stuff you see being talked about, as well as what was that stat that did the rounds? We tax more on beer than we do on our minerals or something crazy. So it's just exactly. All these upside down policies to benefit the corporates and push this agenda.
Yeah. So the energy story is, of course, one of huge mismanagement. The tax system is hugely mismanaged. The government doesn't know what it's doing, but they're continuing to pump the old bring more people in, we'll solve it. But just another little deflection here. The CGT conversation, which of course is now very much in vogue, if you look at the next slide, they're wanting to seem to be doing something, right? So this is now another bit of distraction. This CGT change won't fundamentally change much at all, despite the fact that Bernie Fraser says it's probably a good idea and the Treasury said that, well, it may help first-time buyers, although, you know, whether it will actually harm supply or not sure. This is a misdirection. This is another distraction. Just tackling CGT on investor properties, grandfather for a period of time probably, won't solve anything because this is not the most material issues that need to be discussed. But again, it's another example of misdirection.
You know, politicians skirting around the edges to make you feel like they're doing something about an issue and not actually changing the core, as you say.
Exactly. Well, look at housing. You know, Claire O'Neill keeps coming out with these little stupid videos and nothing's changed. You know, we still aren't building enough and we can't actually get people into houses and The number of houses being built is still falling. The latest construction numbers were low as well. So it's madness. And by the way, just on this chart, next one, CBA puts out this housing affordability calculation, right? And they show that things aren't great. But look, they're now looking at dual average full-time income household buying a medium-priced property. So they are massively now assuming two full-time incomes for a household. Now, if you go back a decade or so, or two, it will be one plus a bit of an income. So they have fundamentally shifted the ground, and that's a real problem. One of the reasons why we now have the situation where the actual median price versus capacity to pay is so broken. And again, it shows you how some of these bad policies are really flocking now through and forcing people to make really bad decisions. So they've got to find somewhere to live because the rentals are so high. So, you know, I'm going to leverage up. But this is not good. This is not good policy. And maybe no surprise then that if you look at the consumer sentiment, it was down both the Melbourne Institute and ANZ Roy Morgan. In fact, the latest Roy Morgan, not on this chart, was up very slightly, but still strongly negative. And that's a real problem, because effectively what it says is that a lot of people are losing confidence in government. They're losing confidence in their ability to make their own financial decisions. And whilst there are some doing really well and benefiting from all of those wages that they did get and all of those performance of stocks and shares, and that proportion is doing well. But the bulk of Australians are in the other bucket, which is they're just hanging on by their fingernails. And unfortunately, politicians are not doing anything to actually address the fundamental core structural issues that we have in the country that needs to be addressed, which is why, politically speaking, we now have a very interesting situation where, of course, one nation's performance is now continuing to rise. And, you know, there's a little bit of movement in the polls, but this chart here shows you the demographic breakdown. And it's fascinating if you look at now where one nation is polling. This is a recent Insights poll. And you can see that in some areas, the proportion who are actually sitting in the One Nation camp is bigger, particularly, for example, in rural and regional areas. And if you look at females, for example, 29% of females, right? That's 27% in the ALP. This is huge. So this is the earthquake response to effectively years and years of bad policy. But my belief is, a lot of these votes going to One Nation are not a vote for something. They are a vote against the Uni Party. They are a vote against the status quo, because the status quo is letting everybody down. And given that the One Nation policies are pretty nebulous at the best of times and sort of shift around a bit, and some of them are quite extreme, I do believe this is a signal of concern and disruption in the minds of people, not necessarily a positive vote for One Nation, rather a vote against the US.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. People are waking up to the old two birds, two wings of the same bird, right? But I've one of my predictions for 2026 was the rise of Pauline Hanson and where this is all leading. And I think it's all kind of part of another agenda, and she's playing a role in all of that. But I can't believe that stat of the dual income. When you know, what was it like in the 60s, 50% of people were married and had a house by 30, and now it's down to like 15% or something. And so that now they decide to assess dual income for affordability. It's just however they can twist these things, it's just crazy.
And the final point to make just on all of this and this political overlay, it's very interesting. There are people now suggesting that actually Albo is deliberately pushing the agenda with regard to high migration, because effectively what he's doing so in doing that is fragmenting the opposition. And so actually his strategy is therefore to maintain his position, because the other side will be more fractured by this debate than Labour. And if that's true, well, that's another indictment on the whole policy approach. But it is also suggesting, again, they're playing games with people's lives, and with effectively saying, well, we'll keep the migration up because actually that will enable us to get re-elected next time. That's pretty shameful.
Yeah, without taking into account the societal effects that we touched on before. So.
Exactly.
Well, great stuff as always, Martin. Hope you guys have enjoyed that one. Links to follow all Martin's work down below, as well as my stuff. And we'll talk to you again next month. Martin, cheers.
See ya.